funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
Imagine a sheriff's deputy hired after taking on a bad guy firsthand, following months of harassment and terroristic threats. This deputy-to-be was actually pressed into service unexpectedly, handed a gun as a civilian, and taught to use it if necessary to defend family by the existing sheriff, at a time when police work often involved volunteer posses. Sounds like an intriguing concept for a novel, doesn't it? Especially when you consider that the events of the novel play out in 1915. The future deputy was a woman, and her fictionalized story is drawn from events that really happened. This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. Amy Stewart was doing research for an unrelated work of nonfiction when she came across a newspaper story about the cop sisters of New Jersey, Constance, Norma, and Florette. Their true story was so intriguing that Stewart decided her next book would be a novel based on the events of their lives. Amy Stewart's previous works of nonfiction include The Drunken Botanist and Wicked Plants. Her novel is called Girl Waits with Gun. She's in town for the DMA's Arts and Letters Live tonight. Amy, welcome back to Think.
Oh, thank you. I'm so glad to be here. And I just have to say, I grew up listening to KERA. So you guys turned me into a lifelong public radio supporter and listener, and I love being here.
Well, that's great. I'm glad it worked.
It did. It worked. Only 20 years of sitting in my parents' back seat driving around Dallas-Fort Worth, and I got hooked.
All right. I'm 2/3 of the way there with my kids. So. So you grew up in North Texas, but there are aspects of this story that feel very Old West to me, even though it takes place in New Jersey.
So this is the interesting thing, actually, about law enforcement at that time, is that every place was the Wild West 100 years ago. There were a lot of places around the country that had basically volunteer police forces. There was no police academy. There weren't really a lot of rules of conduct. A lot of the officers didn't even know what the laws were that they were supposed to enforce. It's amazing how much changes in just 100 years.
It is.
Yeah.
You were poking around for information about the villain in the story, right?
Yes. Yeah. So I was looking for a gin smuggler named Henry Kaufman. I was writing a book about booze. So nothing to do with this at all. And I just thought, you know, if I'm going to put this gin smuggler in my book, I ought to know who he was and what else he did. If it turns out he was a senator, I would like to know that if I put him in the book. And so I found a piece in the New York Times about another guy named Henry Kaufman. I never did find out if it was the same person. Who owned a silk dyeing factory in Paterson, New Jersey in 1914 and got into a fender bender. Basically, he was in a car and they were in a horse and buggy and he just ran him down. And they got into a dispute over the damages to the buggy. And next thing you know, these three sisters, who only wanted payment for the damaged buggy, found themselves under attack, like they messed with the wrong guy. And pretty soon they're getting shots fired at their house and kidnapping threats and arson attempts. And they're just under siege for a year over what started as a really simple dispute. And I thought, what a weird and interesting story. It just captivated me from the beginning.
What's so strange is that a guy with the resources of Henry Kaufman could easily have paid them what they wanted and have been done with them.
Yes. Yeah. And so one of the reasons I wanted to tell this story as fiction is because I didn't know the answer to questions just like that. Like, why did he do what he did? So I had to build his world and figure out what kind of person he was that he could so easily be set off like that. And, you know, one of the another interesting thing about 100 years ago is that alcoholism was really rampant. You know, this is right before Prohibition. And one of the reasons for Prohibition is the sort of drunken, violent, loudish behavior that people were seeing everywhere.
It really was worse before Prohibition than it is today.
It was really worse. Yeah. You know, the suffrage movement and the movement for Prohibition are very closely linked because women really thought, you know, if we could have the vote, we could maybe outlaw liquor and we'd be a lot safer. Women felt very unsafe at home and on the streets because of drunken, crazy behavior from men. And there was no just locking someone up for mistreating a woman. That was never going to happen. So it was about maybe if they stop drinking, they'll behave a little better. So I thought, why did Henry Kaufman do what he did? Well, so there's drinking. There's also untreated mental illness. You know, so 100 years ago, he could have been something of a sociopath and had no one would have caught that early. Right. So that and I made him kind of spoiled and entitled because he was a wealthy person. The people who owned those silk factories were the haves. And then there were all the have nots. So I kind of had to create him out of thin air, and that's what really led me in the direction of this needs to be fiction.
Was it love at first sight as soon as you learned about Constance Kopp?
Yes, yes. I adore her. I chose to tell this story, even though there's three sisters, I chose to tell this story in the first person and in Constance's voice, because here's a woman who's, she's 35 years old when the story starts, unmarried, has no interest in marriage, really wanted to get an education and have a job, and that's really tough to do in 1915. Her mother really discouraged it. Constance was also 6 feet tall and weighed 180 pounds. So she was a large woman. She would have towered over most men at that time. The average height of a man was about 5'7" at that time. So she was in every way a misfit, you know? And I think we could all identify with that, right? We all feel like misfits in one way or another. And she found a way to succeed. Like, she realized that being physically strong could be very useful against a guy like Henry Kaufman. And she used her strength, and it changed her life. It sent her in a new direction.
One of her first encounters with him, she has what she describes as a fist fight with Kaufman.
Yes. You know, what I decided about Constance, and this is not ever been my experience, and it's not the experience of most women, but what I decided about Constance is that she's willing to just throw somebody up against a wall. Mm-hmm. When she gets mad, she shoves, she pushes, she's aggressive. This would never be considered a bad thing in a male, in a hero, right?
Right.
So if this had been a man's story, it would be absolutely expected for the man to haul off and hit the guy who's harassing him. And I thought, I'm going to have Constance have really no hesitation about that. So she gets into a face-to-face confrontation with Henry Kaufman, in which he makes a snide remark about her youngest sister, who's very young and pretty. And she gets so angry that she just sees red, and she sort of throws him up against a wall and cracks the wall, and he bleeds a little bit, and she's sort of towering over him because she's so much taller than him. And it's this moment where she kind of goes, what did I just do?
I kind of love that she goes home, and in her diary or however she's speaking to us, she is like thinking, I can't believe I've just done this thing.
Yes. I can't believe I've just done this thing. But then there are moments later when she's perfectly ready to do it again. Yeah.
So their mother has died by the time this novel opens. But she's really a present as a character. They're always thinking about what mother would have thought.
You know, it's so funny. When in the first draft of this novel, the mother was still alive. In real life, the mother was still alive. I killed her off prematurely.
Sorry, Mrs. Kopp.
I'm sorry, Mrs. Kopp, for sending you to an early grave. It was too complicated. Four women under one roof. It was too much. It was above my pay grade. And I just thought, this story gets a lot simpler if mom is out of the picture. And I killed her off. But because I'd written an entire version of the novel where she was present, I knew her really well. Like, in some ways, it was a good lesson for me as a writer. You know, if I can spend that much time getting to know a character who's not even present in the story, then they can infuse the whole story with their legacy. So, Constance is always reflecting back on her mother and thinking about it. Her mother, and this is true in real life, her mother was an immigrant, came from Austria with her parents in the kind of middle, late 1800s, and was middle class. These were not poor immigrants. In Europe, there was a revolution in 1848, and a lot of wealthier people actually left because there's winners and losers in every revolution, and they were on what they felt was the losing side. So, she was kind of well off in middle class, but also very xenophobic, very prejudiced, very closed off to the world. And here's Constance suddenly finding her way out into the world in a way that her mother would never have approved of.
And the daughters are very American in their outlook on things.
Yes. What I love about this time period right before World War I is we're still a little bit in the Victorian era. And certainly these three girls were all born in the late 1800s and very much under the influence of creaky Victorian morality. And yet here comes the 20th century, and we're starting to get telephones, and there's a few cars out on the road, and we're just creeping very slowly towards the modern age. Now, what they don't know yet is that World War I's going to come and blow all that up, and we're going to be thrust into the modern era in the 1920s. But that hasn't quite happened yet. And so I love this moment where they're figuring out what it means to be an American. They're figuring out what it means to be a woman in a modern age that's maybe coming, but they don't know yet. It's such a fascinating time.
Yeah, I was thinking about the fact that, you know, the changes after World War One. You know, women suddenly had a great deal more independence and they were needed mm-hmm. to do things during the war. And then men sort of successfully put them back in their place. I'm using giant air quotes here. After
right.
World War One, women wouldn't fall for that again after World War Two in the same way.
Yeah, that's interesting. You know, you think about it, the 1920s were kind of a wild ride for everyone, but women did make huge advances during that time. And then I think the Great Depression, it was sort of tough on everybody,
yeah.
right? And it is interesting that in World War II, women went into the factories in huge numbers and had an even bigger role in that war than we had in the First World War. And then after that, we had a little bit of let's stay home and raise kids and keep house. And then it was just over.
Let's talk about the other sisters. There's Florette, who is the youngest sister, and she's kind of this free spirit. She feels very modern to me. Like if she
yes.
lived in 2015, she would just have a cell phone in her hands at all time
right.
and just kind of roll her eyes at the older sisters in the room.
Yeah, yeah. Florette is the youngest by a long shot. So she was born in 1897. So basically, when the 1920s hit, she's going to be in her 20s. So she really is a woman of a new era. And she grew up very sheltered. And this is all true. I actually know this from talking to family members, that she was schooled at home. So she really didn't leave their little farmhouse in New Jersey much at all when she was young. And now mom is gone. Bigger sisters are out doing other things in the world. And she's suddenly seeing an opportunity for herself. And she was an incredibly talented seamstress and very fashionable, made all her own clothes, and went on to continue to be very fashionable and a very successful sort of tailor, and also had a real interest in the theater. I mean, I have newspaper clippings of Florette trying out for singing competitions in Patterson. So she really did have aspirations to the stage. So she's like the little, I don't know, kind of like the little wild bird of the of the house, and has much bigger ideas for herself
than
her sisters do.
Did you decide if she was as good a performer as she wished to be?
Actually, no. In my mind, she's not. Mm-hmm. In my mind, she thinks she's much better than she actually is. And, you know, if you want to talk about comparisons to today, I think people tend to forget how much hard work is involved in being successful in something like singing or the arts, or even in sports. You know, I hear all this stuff now about Steph Curry and all these kids wanting to try to imitate his moves, and basketball coaches saying, you know, a lot of work went into that. He
right.
didn't start doing that when he was 12.
And then
you
make
understand.
A YouTube video the next week. Right.
Right. That's not how it works.
And then the third sister is Norma, who is she's funny. I mean, unintentionally so, but
right.
she's a little bit withdrawn from the world, but she has this passion for pigeons.
Yeah, so Norma is a real curmudgeon. And Norma was the hardest one for me to figure out because she didn't show up in the newspaper articles about the Kopp sisters that I was finding. She tended to stay out of the limelight, which meant that, I mean, I have hundreds of newspaper clippings about these women, so I know a lot about them, but less about her until I met the family, until I actually tracked them down, and some of them were able to tell me about their Aunt Norma, who died in the 1950s. And she was very grumpy. She didn't like people. She was very blunt and opinionated and would make the most awful statements to people and not care what anyone thought. And I kind of loved that about her.
Yeah.
I thought, oh, I know women like this. The total grouch, that grouchy aunt
right.
who doesn't like anyone.
We're speaking this hour with author Amy Stewart about her new novel, Girl Waits with Gun. She's in town for the DMA's Arts and Letters live event tonight. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Summer Youth Program with hands-on workshops in game design, coding, robotics, visual arts, math, and language arts for students entering grades K through 12 at SMU's Plano campus. Online registration is available at smu.edu/summeryouth.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with author Amy Stewart. Her new novel is called Girl Waits with Gun. She'll be speaking tonight at the DMA for Arts and Letters Live. If you'd like to be part of our conversation, you can email think@kera.org or call 1-800-933-5372. How much did you have to learn, Amy, about the practice of keeping pigeons as a hobby?
Oh, that is one of my favorite things. You know, so the pigeons are fiction. Norma Kopp did not actually keep pigeons, but I needed a way to soften her personality. Mm-hmm. I want to let her be an unrelenting grump, right? Like, I want her to be able to do that, but there has to be some redeeming factor. And I thought, what women like that who I know, what is it about them? And I thought, you know, they always have a little dog. And I didn't want to
seven cats.
Right. And they don't like anyone else, but they love their little dog. Yeah. But I didn't want to make it a little dog. And I thought messenger pigeons, because believe it or not, still in the 1910s, people were using messenger pigeons as a form of communication. So it was a technology that was actually in use. And I thought it would be fun to learn about. I have all kinds of pigeon keeping manuals from the 1910s. I'm married to a rare book dealer. So these things come to me. And I keep chickens. So I have some idea about what it means to have a flock of birds in the backyard. And I love it. I'm fascinated by that.
And to be clear, she is very grumpy. She's not mean. She clearly cares about her family. She just has a very pessimistic worldview.
Right. She's like fiercely loyal to her family. The way my editor described it is she's that aunt who shows up at the hospital when you have your baby and tells you she doesn't like what you named your baby. But she's there.
Right.
She's always there.
Right.
Yeah.
And there's a brother in this family, too, Francis, who's a little tough to figure out. He seems to be a decent guy, but he just does not understand how these three women would want to be independent from him.
That's right. You know, I really wanted Francis to be a good guy of his generation. And in his generation, if you had an unmarried sister out there in the world, you moved her into the house and stuck her in the attic.
Right.
found a little room for her, and she was your responsibility. Women really were the responsibility of some man or another in that era, and even legally so, still at that time. So he was well intentioned when he said, "Why don't you girls, now that mom's dead, why don't you sell the farm and move in with us? And you can, I don't know what you'll do. You can help with the cooking and the cleaning and whatever." And so the Kopp sisters are horrified by this idea and have no interest at all in becoming dependents of their brother. But for the time, he was doing a kind and well-intentioned thing.
Where is Papa Kopp in all this?
Well, isn't that an interesting question? So I let out a little bit of his true story in the novel, which is that he worked in the wine industry, and then he was kind of a bartender or a guy who worked in saloons, and then he sort of disappeared. And that's true to what I really know about him. But I keep asking myself in future books, I mean, this is a series, so there's more books coming, you know, when am I going to have him turn back up again? And so it's an intriguing question. Where is Dad?
So the Kopp sisters actually took Henry Kaufman to court. He had been messing with them all this time. In the interim, though, they were really afraid that he was going to harm them, and specifically to harm Florette. He essentially threatened to sexually traffic her.
Yes, and this was very common at the time. So the term white slavery refers to the kidnapping of women to be forced into prostitution. This was a big fear at that time. You know, young women were voluntarily moving into cities for the first time and wanting to have a job and live on their own. And this was brand new. The notion that a girl wouldn't just go from her parents' house to her husband's house was weird and terrifying. And somehow out of that developed this really almost a myth. I mean, not that sexual trafficking hasn't always been with us and still is today, but for the most part, an overblown fear. So these threatening letters that Henry Kaufman was sending were common at the time. And it was basically, pay me $1,000 or I'll kidnap your youngest daughter. And that happened a lot. And people really did pay. Enrique Caruso received similar blackmail letters, more of a pay me
the opera singer.
Yes. Mm-hmm. More of a pay me $1,000 or I'll burn your house down kind of threat, but a similar thing. And he kept paying them and paying them and paying them till he realized there was no end to it and finally went to the police. So these things happen. Now, was Henry Kaufman serious about this? Was he really going to kidnap Florette? Probably not. It was probably more like a copycat crime because they were in the paper so much. But I have the text of the actual threatening letters that Henry Kaufman sent because I have some court records from the case. And in fact, you know, tonight at the museum, I'll have pictures of them. You can actually see the real letters that he was sending. So this would have been terrifying to them.
Another great character in this story is Sheriff Heath, Robert Heath.
Yes.
What a new age kind of thinker.
Right. I love Sheriff Heath. I was very lucky to find, first of all, he was in the newspaper all the time, right? So I was able to keep up with what he was doing, not just the kinds of crimes he was involved in, but speeches he gave and interviews he gave. And he was very progressive. He was a reformer. He wanted to get at the root causes of poverty and crime, try to keep people out of jail in the first place. I think it's so interesting that today we're talking about our incarceration rate and keeping people out of jail. And 100 years ago, he was talking about that. I have transcripts of speeches he gave that show what a crusader and a reformer and a progressive guy he was. So I liked him right away. I was also lucky to get pictures of him. I showed up at the sheriff's department there in New Jersey, and the jail where he lived and worked is still there. It's not being used as a jail anymore, but they have their offices there. And they had all these old photographs. They said, Sheriff Heath, we know about Sheriff Heath. Look at this. And they had pictures of him, of Constance, of the jail. And so knowing what he looks like he's a very kind of kind, nice-looking man, I just have a real affection for him, which I think sort of shows through in the book a little bit. He's just a lovely, lovely person.
Can you imagine living in the jail that you were running for your municipality? Sounds awful.
No, and it was totally the way things worked. The sheriff would be given a budget out of which he was to feed and house the inmates, and he just had to figure it out. And sometimes the sheriff or the sheriff's wife would do all the cooking. I mean, it was really such a weirdly homegrown operation back in those days.
So we have all of these threats going on. There's also a subplot. Constance meets a young woman who has really been done wrong by Henry Kaufman. Mm-hmm. Not only did he leave her with a child, he then, it appears, stole that child back.
Well, here's what happened. When I found out that Henry Kaufman owned a silk dyeing factory, I thought, okay, well, what about the silk industry in Patterson? What's that about? I didn't know anything about it.
I didn't know there was one until I read your book.
Exactly. So the town of Patterson was all silk all the time in those days. And in 1913, so a year before my book begins, the silk strikes. The Patterson silk strikes were a huge national story. Tens of thousands of workers walked off the job. And the industrial workers of the world, the Wobblies, right? The IWW came in to organize. If you saw the movie Reds, you might remember Warren Beatty's character, Jack Reed.
Right.
He was there, as was Margaret Sanger, who went on to found Planned Parenthood, as was Elizabeth Gurley Flynn, wonderful early suffragist and labor activist. So this was a huge moment in the history of the American labor movement. All these workers went out on strike for 6 months. They couldn't eat. They couldn't feed their families. And so the union organized for the workers to send their children into New York City to live with families who were sympathetic to the cause.
To support their children for them, effectively.
To feed the kids.
Yeah.
Yeah. So imagine doing that. Imagine taking your kids and just putting them on a train. I have pictures of them with little notes pinned onto their coats to live with complete strangers because you can't possibly feed them. So that really happened, the children's evacuation. And in fact, some of those kids never came back. And I got so sucked into that story that I thought I have to find a way to tell this story because this is part of the world they were living in at the time. And so that's why I had Constance literally run into a worker at the factory who'd been profoundly impacted by the strike and the children's evacuation so that I could kind of get into that world and see the other side of Henry Kaufman's world through the eyes of the workers.
And it's understandable that anybody would hear that story and be moved by it. But for Constance, there's a particular resonance.
Yeah. Yes, there is.
so we won't give too much away, but there's more to her relationships than is apparent when the novel opens.
Constance has a complicated history that comes out in stages throughout the book. I won't say too much, so I don't spoil it for people who haven't read the book. But it's true. The research that I did took me into courthouses. I got a lot of genealogical documents. So in addition to actually meeting the family, I uncovered things in courthouse records that even people in the family didn't know. So there's a family secret at the heart of the story that that is really all true as far as anyone will ever know.
When you met, you tracked down and met living descendants of the Kopp sisters. Mm-hmm. How did it work? How often did you tell them things they hadn't known, and how often did they tell you things you hadn't known?
You know, I had a lot of information for them. Keep in mind, the people who are alive today, for the most part, didn't know the Kopps directly. They only knew them through family stories. You know, you hear stories about your great-grandmother or somebody like that. So it was mostly that kind of thing. I did meet Florette's son. Florette being the youngest, and she had children a little later in life, and so her son is in his 80s, and he's still alive. And they knew little bits and pieces and were able to fill in some details, but I came at them with like hundreds of newspaper articles that were all digitized that, yeah, I could just say here. And I threw some money and some time and resources at their family tree. So I was digging through the archives in Manhattan and getting their great grandparents' marriage certificates and stuff like that. So I had their genealogy in a way that they hadn't gotten around to doing yet. And it was wonderful. The family was so supportive and so willing to help. They shared some amazing things with me. There's a letter that Constance wrote to Deputy Morris, who's a character in the book, thanking him for his help in the case. And they scanned that letter and sent it to me. And when I saw her handwriting and her own words, like just how she signed her name and how she expressed herself, it was so moving to me because Constance was already alive and well in my head as a fictional character that I sometimes forgot that I hadn't just invented out of whole cloth. And then to get a letter from her is it just sent chills up my spine. It was magical.
Had you always, in the years that you were working on nonfiction books and articles, did you always think there's a novel in me, I'm just waiting to figure out what it is?
Oh, yes. There are several failed novels in drawers.
Uh-huh.
So in between at least two of those nonfiction books was an attempted and rejected novel. And what was different with the Kopp sisters is, I really fell in love with them on pretty much the first day that I found anything out about them. But then I spent about 6 months kind of on and off trying to piece their story together. And once I really had it and I understood the entire lives of these three sisters, I started to feel a powerful obligation to them. You know, I thought, I found you. No one's ever heard of these women. These are not famous people. Mm-hmm. There's not a Wikipedia page about them. The local historical society had never heard of them. No one knows about them. And I just thought, everybody forgot about you. And anyone could have found you, but I found you. And I'm not going to put you down. I'm not going to be talked out of writing this book. It was kind of a midlife crisis book for me. You know, I'm in my middle 40s. It's that time in your life when you sort of go, I am willing to throw everything away.
It's now or never, right?
To do this, yeah, thing. Yes. And I just said, I'm going to write these books no matter what. If nobody wants to publish them, I'm going to write them anyway.
There's a lot, in case it's not evident to people, there's a lot of humor in this. I mean, it's not like really broad humor, but did you know from the beginning that that was going to be an element of this?
Yes. You know, humor is very hard to write. It's, mm-hmm, hard to do deliberately. What I find is that sometimes I just crack myself up.
Mm-hmm.
So those are the things that stay in there. And some people find them funny and some people don't. And there are things in the book that I didn't think were funny until someone else said they were. And in fact, I'm trying to remember if it was the Dallas Morning News reviewer. Some newspaper reviewer loved this this line where Constance, when she shoves Henry Kaufman up against the wall, he's looking up at her and he says, if you want to pick on a man your own size, I'll send one over.
Right.
And at the time, I didn't even think that was a funny line, but it is kind of hilarious because he's so little. You know, you can imagine a Danny DeVito type, right, character saying something like that, and it would come across as funny. So it's a little stuff like that, but I wanted it to be in Constance's voice. And my own great-grandmother, although she lived here in she lived in Fort Worth most of her life. She's from Pennsylvania, and she was born in about 1905. So she's sort of close a little bit in location and generation to the Copps. And I watched over and over again this home movie I have of her in the 90s talking to the camera. And she was a very self-possessed woman, very able to speak in a forthright way and hold the attention of a crowd, and funny in this very dry, sophisticated, almost but not quite sarcastic way. And that's what I wanted for Constance.
It's strange to think about being an unmarried woman at a time where people would think it was odd if you wanted to have a job.
It was so odd. You know, the newspapers at that time, it was jobs for men and jobs for women. Hmm. In the jobs for women section, you could be a domestic worker, you could be a factory worker, or you could be a secretary. That's all there was. And when women did anything at all unusual, it made the papers. So part of the reason I know so much about Constance is that her exploits ran in newspapers in Nevada, in Texas, all over the country, because people thought it was so strange that there was a woman doing any of this. I mean, the title, Girl Waits with Gun, the title of the book, is a newspaper headline about her standing on a street corner doing kind of a sting operation to try to catch Henry Kaufman. That story ran all over the country. Hmm. I found an article about two women running a foot race. Two women were going to go outside and run fast. And that made the news, right? That was so weird.
It's even weird that, that headline at the time was Girl Waits with Gun. This is a 35-year-old woman who owns property and kind of has her life together.
Oh, yeah, sure. The language is a funny thing. I actually had, and it was a man actually, lecture me about referring to her as a girl, as if I don't know.
Right.
As a woman in 2015, as if I don't know that grown women should not be called girls. But I really tried to keep the language at the time. So there's a lot of girl, there's a lot of ladies. Ladies is a word that I sort of hate, but it would have been used a lot at the time. There's a lot of her being called dear. So there is a lot of very small, sexism that permeates the book and will in future books as well. And for the most part, it just rolls on by. Mm-hmm. I really wanted to think about how was she living in the world she was living in, and how did she think about it at the time?
She had bigger fish to fry than being called a girl.
Absolutely.
Yeah. We're speaking this hour with author Amy Stewart about her new novel, Girl Waits with Gun. She's in town for the DMA's Arts and Letters Live tonight. If you'd like to join us, you can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. You can email think@kera.org or call 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Summer Youth Program with hands-on workshops in game design, coding, robotics, visual arts, math, and language arts for students entering grades K through 12 at SMU's Plano campus. Online registration is available at smu.edu/summeryouth.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with author Amy Stewart. Her new novel is called Girl Waits with Gun. She'll speak tonight at the DMA's Arts and Letters Live event. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. How do you get into the voice of someone writing 100 years ago?
That has been the biggest challenge with this book. The thing that I spend the most time thinking about is the language. So I read a lot of books from the era, which is wonderful. That's a treat. Like, mm-hmm. I've been on a big Edith Wharton kick lately. Willa Cather, Mary Roberts Reinhardt, who's a crime fiction writer who wrote a lot at that time. One of the wonderful things about Google Books scanning all the books that they have is that I can find transcripts of speeches that were made in the 1910s, congressional testimony, court trials, conference proceedings. And so I can get how people, when they were just up in front of an audience talking in their everyday voice and someone was transcribing that word for word, what that sounded like. And I keep a huge file. I use this software program called Evernote that researchers use to keep track of all their files and all their stuff. And I have this enormous file in Evernote of interesting words and phrases that just strike me as a little different than how we would say something today. So, for instance, it was very common at the time to say, tell about it. I'm going to go in there and tell about it. My copy editor marked that and said, did you mean tell him about it? And I'm like, no, tell about it is how they said it. So I have this like treasure trove of how that worked. I also read my books aloud several times before they go off to the publisher at the end. And so in that process, I'm forever trying to think about, does this sound too modern? And there's some good research tools now. I tell you, the internet makes this so much easier. Google has this thing called Ingram Viewer, where you can type in a series of words and it will chart how commonly those words were used over time in all the books they've scanned. So, for instance, lipstick was hyphenated at that time, far more commonly than not. So all those little things sort of go into the language. But my biggest fear is that it'll start to sound flat and modern. I even, near the end of the process, I'll print it all out and I'll reshuffle all the pages of the manuscript and pick up pages at random and just look for a weak spot on every page. Every page has a weak spot, and try to turn it from the worst thing on the page to the best thing on the page in terms of period sound. So yeah, I'm kind of obsessive about the language stuff.
Do you narrate the audiobook version?
I don't, thank goodness. They found, I had narrator approval, which means I get to pick. But what that means is that they send you three and you get to pick which of those three you like. And the first three they sent me, these were three very young women who used all the mannerisms that young women use when they talk. So the up talk, you know, the phrasing things as a question that aren't questions, and the vocal fry, the little growly thing in the throat. Thank you for that example. I was like, no. This was a woman. She was 35 years old. She was a large woman. She was substantial in how she sounded, and she was talking 100 years ago. We need somebody who sounds like a grown up. And they found this woman, Christina Moore. Who didn't find her. She's one of their narrators, but she's from that very part of New Jersey. So she was able to voice all the males, all the men. Their accents are so interesting and wonderful. And I got her to come to a few of my events on the East Coast and stand up in front of the audience.
Oh, wow.
So I didn't have to read. She could read. I would take her with me everywhere if I could.
It is interesting. I mean, I love audiobooks, but the narration really does make a difference. It can be very hard to get over it if you don't like the way someone reads.
Yes. Yes, it can. And one of my secrets about these books that is hopefully not really obvious, but it's a thing that I do, is that when I'm reading them aloud just to work on the language, I'm reading them in a Texas accent.
Really? You don't have a Texas accent.
I know. I've kind of lost it, but it's there. I can get back to it. Mm-hmm. If I'm here long enough, if I try, if I have a margarita or two in
you
me.
You might could.
I might could. But I somehow know these very strong women because I know them. I know Southern women like that, right? Like, I don't know any New Jersey women, but I know 100 incredibly strong, interesting, outspoken, declarative, powerful Texas women. So I'm always reading it in this Texas accent to myself in my head. And so I'm very glad to hand this over to Christina, who can get that New Jersey accent on top of all of that secret Southernism that's in there somewhere that is just between me and the manuscript.
Talking to you now and having talked to you about The Drunken Botanist and Wicked Plants, it strikes me that you love writing, but what you really love is researching.
I do love research. I do. It can be a problem to stop and actually write. Mm-hmm. I can get very sucked into the research, and I have to kick myself off the internet. When I'm working on the manuscript, I deliberately don't look things up because the rest of my day will disappear. If I need to decide what kind of fabric is around the edge of Florette's collar, the rest of the day will disappear into the fashion of the 1910s. So I just have to put in XXXX and come back and do it later. The research is fascinating. I love reading old newspapers, so I can get very lost in those archives. And again, since so many of them are digital, it's something that I can sit up all night with my laptop reading.
And you went to Paterson, New Jersey. It would seem as if you could have extrapolated from what you read what the jail was like, that sort of thing. What made you want to be there?
Oh, being there changes everything. First of all, the jail itself, getting to walk into that jail, because they let me, it's empty, they let me walk around.
It's amazing that it still stands.
Oh, it's under historic preservation, so it'll always be there. Yeah, it just gave me such a powerful feeling for the whole thing. There's a creek that ran behind their house, and Fleurette got shot at when she went down to the creek. That really happened. And I was able to figure out where their house was by looking at some old land deeds. There were no addresses to help me with that. But I got there, and there was the creek.
Wow.
And to get to stand in the creek where somebody shot at Fleurette, to bring my imaginary world and the real world together like that is just the most powerful and strangest thing. If anyone listening today is a novelist who writes complete fiction, you can imagine how weird it would be to be able to get on a plane and go stand where your characters once stood. You know, I stood on the corner where the girl waited with the gun.
There now?
Well, there on one street corner is an old brick building. And in fact, I'll have a picture of it tonight at the museum. An old brick building that was probably there at the time. The other three corners are all new and different. But downtown Patterson is very much intact. Those old buildings are still there. They're sort of slip covered and covered up with new signs and like that. But you can, in your mind, sort of strip all of that away. And the architecture is still how it would have been.
I, to be honest, didn't notice when I was reading the book, and then I read some reviews that, you know, multiple people pointed out the fact that there is no romance in this book, and people commented on how refreshing that is, and I guess it didn't occur to me because I was just drawn to their stories, and they didn't have to, like, also get a boyfriend at the end in order for it to be a good story.
Right. You know, so on the very first day when I discovered this story, my husband came home from work that day and asked me how my drunken botanist research had gone. I'm like, I didn't do any drunken botanist. You're not going to believe what I found. And so on that first day, I was like, oh, and I bet the sheriff's very handsome and they fall in love and live happily ever after. And as soon as those words were out, I'm like, no, they don't. This isn't going to be a love story. Mm-hmm. This is not going to be a story about how she finds a man who makes her whole. Because, first of all, in real life, it doesn't look like she did. And second of all, I think we can have one book where there are a lot of women who are not at the business of finding men as the primary objective of the book. So now I kind of love playing with that because I think that Constance and Sheriff Heath did have an interesting kind of spark between them and a connection between them. But, you know, men and women didn't work together in those days. You know, you and I work in modern workplaces where we can have male colleagues who we feel very connected to and very close to. People joke about their office husband,
right?
Or they just have lifelong work relationships that are incredibly meaningful. But how confusing would that have been 100 years ago? You know, Sheriff Heath sees this woman who is, first of all, as tall as he is and as physically capable as he is, and who has the nerve and the guts to go do all the things he does, and he must admire that tremendously. What does that admiration mean to a, you know, a married man? So there's something about their connection that neither one of them can figure out. And so readers can't quite figure it out either. And they do ask me about it. But I love that I hear from so many readers how refreshing it is to read a book about a woman that's not primarily about falling in love.
An interesting trend to me is over the past decade or so, there have always been series of books, but it seems like now that's what publishers really want. They want you to give them a book that can lead you to five more. Did you know from the minute that you found these characters that this could be that, or did it sort of become apparent as you were writing?
I knew from right away. I said this has to be fiction and it has to be a series, and not in the sense of murder mysteries where there's a dead body on page 10 and you know who did it by page 300. But more,
not that there's anything wrong with
not,
that.
No. I love those books. I'm a huge P.D. James fan. I love crime fiction. But in their case, the way their lives play out over the next 15 years or so is very much divided into little eras, little epics. You know, the war being an obvious example that we all know is coming. And so I could see right away, like, each one of these would be an interesting novel. And I can tell the larger journey that they're taking in the world as these three single women and where that takes them. And I can see it playing out over several novels. I think what's really influenced this in books is television.
Hmm.
I think, you know, a show like The Wire, for instance, really lets a lot of writers sat back and looked at that and said, oh, I see. I could really explore this world over several books and my readers would stick with me. My readers are smart enough to do that because we see with TV, television viewers are smart enough to hang in there with a long story told over several seasons.
I always like it as a reader because you know that moment where you finish, you come to the last 10 or 15 pages of a book you've loved, and you get a little panicky. Like,
yes.
What comes next? And you look for something else by that author. You look for something similar, and it's never quite the same.
I know.
Knowing that there's something else coming is always nice.
It is. I always get that terrible feeling of letdown. After I finish a book I really love, I just walk around for a few days in a terrible mood. Like, there will never be another book that great again. It's ruined. So, yeah, that's going to be fun. I'm thinking about experimenting with maybe telling some of these stories from different points of view, letting other characters take the lead. So I'm doing something different from a cookie cutter series and seeing how far I can push it. And we'll see if my readers stick with me for that.
Do you feel like you have more latitude moving forward? I mean, the events of this novel were reasonably heavily documented, and you could take a lot of details from real life. Mm-hmm. Do you feel like you've got more space to play with the events of their lives after this?
Well, if I know what happened, I'm going to use it. Mm-hmm. So the task I set forward for myself as a writer is that I have these real events, and then there are spaces in between them that I can fill in with fiction. But if it really happened, it's going to stay in. So the second book, which comes out in September, is very much based on what really happened. It happens to be a case that Constance worked on that I know a lot about. It was extensively documented. But there are others that are very thin. I have one little 2-paragraph newspaper clipping. And so from there, I can kind of build out that story and ask myself what did they leave out in the paper, which is fun.
How did people respond to a woman wearing a deputy star back in 1915, 1916?
So I loved researching the history of women in law enforcement at that time. And it was a weird moment because women deputies and women police officers were primarily thought of as more like social workers. Mm-hmm. They were there to handle the women and children who came into the law enforcement system. They weren't really expected to go out and chase down bad guys and slap the handcuffs on them. In fact, the sort of dividing line, if you ask, you know, was this woman really a police officer? The question is, did she have arrest authority? Did she have a gun, a badge, handcuffs, and could she actually arrest someone? A lot of women, early women police officers didn't have arrest authority. Constance did. So she actually could chase somebody down in the street and say, you're under arrest, you're coming with me. That was remarkable. And it was kind of seen as a joke. Women definitely got teased a lot if they were out in, and there weren't really police uniforms, but especially for women, they had to make their own. They had to figure out what a uniform might be and make it at home and put a badge on it. So they were definitely seen as oddities.
Did she have a really fashionable uniform made for her by Fleurette?
Fleurette, certainly in my telling of it, Fleurette does make all her own clothes, but Fleurette's very practical about it. You know, where's your gun going to go? Where are your handcuffs going to go? So it has to be clothes she can move in. She has to be able to run in shoes. So she wears, and I think Constance would have had really big feet if she was 6 feet tall. So she wears these big old ugly uncomfortable boots because it would have been hard to find any good shoes for her. So she's not very fashionable. She didn't care about fashion, but Fleurette does, and Fleurette's going to make things that favor her, but also just physically let her move. She really does have to be able to throw herself down and roll around on the sidewalk with a bad guy.
Oh, now I'm very excited for novel two.
Oh, yes.
Author Amy Stewart's first novel is called Girl Waits with Gun. She's in town for the DMA's Arts and Letters Live event tonight. Amy, it's always a pleasure. Thank you so much for making time for us.
Oh, this was so great. Thank you.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Samantha Guzman is associate producer and Jeff Whittington is executive producer. I'm on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. The show's email address is think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.